Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Okay, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Not that anyone at Connoisseur Media would say, sure, Melissa, take another day off. There's no way. But I'm keeping my fingers crossed that the results are really good and that the U.S. will try to adopt this four-day work week idea. According to some recent surveys from participants, most of the companies participating in this four-day work week pilot program going on in Britain say that they have seen no loss of productivity during the experiment. And actually, in some cases, they've seen a significant improvement in their work. So, of course, the question is, will the U.S. adopt this way of working? For all of that and more, Julie Bauke is back for Julie on the Job, and she is our career strategist on WICC. Hey, Julie, how are you?
Good morning. You're right, Melissa. This is interesting news, although if people have at all been paying attention over the last several years, it's also not a surprise.
I agree with you. And I think in a lot of industries, like I said, unfortunately, my industry will never be a 4-day work week just because
right.
For some reason, people want their news. I mean, every day of the week. And luckily, they give
every
me weekends.
Day.
I know.
Rude.
I know. It is actually really rude, guys. Why can't you just let me have my Fridays? No, I'm just kidding. So
right.
But for most others, though, like I look at my sister, who's a physical therapist. She works a 4-day work week and loves it. Absolutely loves it. But when she was in school, you know, in medical school, that wasn't really a thing that people talked about, 4-day work weeks. But it seems to be picking up, though.
Yeah, there was this study that started 3 months ago. So they're halfway through a 6-month study in Britain where it was 73 companies agreed to participate in this experiment. And 41 companies responded to the halfway point survey. And 35 of the 41 said they were likely or extremely likely to consider continuing it. All but two of those 41 companies said productivity was either the same or had improved. And six companies said it significantly improved.
Hmm.
So the one thing people think of when they think of a 4-day work week is like, okay, we work Monday through Thursday, we're off on Friday. But it doesn't have to be like that. They don't have to be the same 4 days for everyone,
mm-hmm.
which really opens up a lot of options because hardly any place can close its doors, you know, and say, come back Monday, you know, every Friday. And so it's when you start thinking about it and saying, okay, it doesn't have to be the same 4 days for everyone. It doesn't even have to be the same 4 days every week. But if we start taking a look at how we might make that work, and so it'd be 4 10-hour days, and you know, people would be given the option of, in a lot of cases, come in, don't come in, et cetera. The point is, you're given the responsibility to get this work done. And you have to be very specific on that. And just like with work from anywhere or work from home, some more progressive companies have said, we don't care if you do it riding a unicycle on Main Street. We just want, you know, I mean, we just want the work done. And
yeah.
if we can trust you to get that work done, then let's have at it. And so, you know, these companies in Britain have said, we're going to pilot this. We're going to just try it with no promise that they're going to keep it. And that's what I think is the secret sauce here, is you figure out a way to pilot it for a period of time. You communicate very clearly upfront to your people what the expectations are, under which circumstances you would consider keeping it, and what are the things that would have to happen for you to abandon it. And it is amazing when people have an incentive like this, an incentive that actually helps them live their life, how they actually, you know, chin the bar and beyond and actually do what's expected of them, because something like this is so valuable. You know, we've heard, if you've ever heard the phrase golden handcuffs, and what that generally means is there's a perk or something in your job that makes it nearly impossible for you to leave.
Mm.
And it's generally, that phrase has generally been tied to money. Bonuses, you know, I got to stay till January, or, you know, they keep these incredible longer term incentive plans in place as our golden handcuffs. And they're tying it, it's generally being tied to money. But what the last few years have taught us is that, you know, that's not what keeps most people.
Mm.
It's just not. There needs
right.
to be other things. I mean, I might have told you in the past, I worked for a company where we got off every 2 o'clock every Friday, every summer. And I'm telling you, that felt like an extra day off. And it was for sure golden handcuffs for people, especially in the summer.
Now, I'm curious, Julie, because we are in a nation that is compared all the time to other countries. And like, I think education for a second will sometimes be criticized because you look at other countries where kids are not taking summer vacations or they're in school longer than our kids are. And we're like, oh, we're really doing a disservice to our kids. And okay, and to some extent, maybe we are. But why do you think the less days you work, the more productive people are? Because the math doesn't, if you look at it on paper, you're like, that doesn't make sense. I'm losing an entire day where I could be doing, you know, group work together or seeing people in the office or whatever the case may be. If you're an employer and you're saying, I don't know, Julie, I'm not convinced. How could you be more productive with one less day in the workspace? What would you say to that?
So first, it's generally 4/10. So it's still 40 hours. But it's over 4 days instead of five. And for a lot of people, they're working that anyway. So what happens is you give people, when you think about all the sectors of your life, whether it's family, relationships, health, spirituality, money, hobbies, you know, all those things, if you give people an extra day to focus, an extra calendar day to focus on the other things, what they're finding in the study is that people are exercising. They're taking care of their appointments, their professional appointments, their meetings, their personal time. They're developing new hobbies. And that helps clear your mind so that you are more focused and mentally healthy and physically healthy at work. It's sort of like you've heard the phrase, rising tide lifts all boats. And when you give people the opportunity to develop the non-work sectors of their lives, they show up healthier, in a better place mentally, more appreciative, more engaged. And so in those 4 days, you are going to have a more well-rounded, healthier person showing up to do the work because they're not worrying about all the things that aren't getting done. So our typical model of, let's just call it 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, that means we have to take time off for our doctor's appointment. You know, we have to take time off to help our kids with things because those places aren't open on Saturday and Sunday. But what if you got a chance to get all that stuff done? Not only would you get it done, but then you wouldn't be worrying about it during the week. And so
that's
it just
point.
Allows you to have, you know, a more evenly balanced life than you show up healthier in every way when it's time to do your job.
A 4-day work week. I'm sitting here with my intern, Isabella, and she's like, it's a game changer. If somebody offered 4 days and I said, Isabella, I love your optimism, but you want to go into news just like me, so you'll never get that. Sorry about that, Isabella. But for many other people, the option of a 4-day work week don't sound that bad. We're talking a little bit about that with Julie Bauke this morning. She's our career strategist. She is Julie on the Job every week here on WICC. So my question, Julie, is this seems like you were saying the golden handcuffs. This is really an amazing opportunity for people. I know for myself, if I had a 4-day work week, it would allow me to not want to take vacation time so often because I would do 3-day weekends, long weekends, things like that. So I could tell you right now, this would be amazing for me and you'd keep me forever and ever. But I want to know how much easier you think employers would have it to recruit and retain workers if they offered the 4-day work week.
To quote Isabella, it is a game changer. You can have, if you have a really crappy culture and a 4-day work week, you know, that's not going to be as effective. But if you have a decent culture with decent people running it, and frankly, most of the companies who would try this would be pretty progressive thinkers. And if you had that and you put that out there in your job posting, people would trip all over themselves to apply. It's that big of a deal for people's lives. And not only – so imagine you're working someplace with a 4-day work week, and it's going pretty darn well. Let's say you're – on a scale of 1 to 10, your career happiness is a 6. You know, you're like, it's a pretty good place to work. And someone else comes along and says, wow, you know, like, yeah, this job looks a lot better, but it's a 5-day work week. Huh. Yeah, I think I'll stay right where I am. I mean, I think it's going to be that big of a deal. Now think about in sort of the typical work week. Remember, how excited we get for a 3-day weekend?
Yes.
Yay, Memorial Day is coming. Yay, Labor Day. Now people in traditional schedules are saying, well, darn, you know, no more big, long weekends scheduled until Thanksgiving. And so when we have those 3-day weekends to look forward to, there's something about, I mean, just increasing your weekend by 1 day is it's so significant in how you relax, on the things you get done. And so if you had that every week, you would show up as a different person on those 4 days. And I also believe that most people would work harder because you don't want to risk losing your job. You don't want to risk being on the layoff list because you were, you know, kind of slacking. You'd be like, yeah, I'm going to hang on to this job as long as I can and do the best I can. And then if you have that situation in your company and you have a handful of people who aren't giving it their all, you can feel more comfortable letting them go, you know, addressing just those people instead of everybody, and you, because you will not have a hard time filling those positions. And so it gives you, as an employer, it gives you some of your leverage back that's been lost over the last few years, frankly.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, I'm also curious, Julie, you had said before, and I think this is a good point to talk about too, when you hear 4 day work week, people might think, okay, so Monday through Thursday, but everybody gets Friday through Sunday off. That may not be the case. What do you think about if you're somebody who comes in and is like, hey, I'd rather have, you know, my Mondays off or something like that. What do you think about that? Like, do you think employees, if they know they're going to a company that says, hey, we do a 4 day work week, is that something appropriate to say, hey, I know you guys typically give the Friday off, but I think that Mondays actually would be better for my, you know, whatever it is, my kids or whatever. Like, is that something appropriate to ask your employers about? Is doing maybe then there are people who are like, hey, I'd rather work weekend. Thursday through Sunday would be great. What do you think about that?
So it depends on your industry. If you have a strictly Monday through Friday type of operation, let's say it's an insurance company, and you know, you, unless you're in claims, handling claims all weekend, it's probably going to be a Monday through Friday. But if you, and I would ask them, let's say, you know what, I understand that you have a 4 day work week policy. Help me understand how that works. And then listen to what they say and, you know, say, and here's my situation. I take care of my elderly parents on Wednesdays and Sundays. And if there's any way that we could structure my work week that way, that would be great. But regardless, I'm very interested in working here. I love your culture. I've heard great things about it, blah, blah, blah. It's always okay to express a preference. It's not okay to demand it, but it's always okay to express a preference. If you don't advocate for yourself, nobody else will. You know, I mean, I think this sort of, well, you know, you're going to have to guess what I need, that a lot of us go into work with. And then what you do is you're putting all the responsibility and the ownership on your boss, you know, and,
yeah,
you know,
true.
If you don't
right.
speak up for yourself, you can't expect to get what you're asking for. But there's a way to do it.
Yeah. People
and it
can't
might
read
be,
minds.
You know, I and not, of course, everybody wants Friday or Monday off. I mean, generally, but if you really are trying to help people meet their life needs, it might be a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday because of all the things. Maybe I volunteer in my kids' classroom on Thursday.
And
it also might rotate. You might not have the same day off every week. I honestly don't think you're going to get too many complaints about that.
Yeah.
Because you're getting that extra day off. And the expectation can be, look, we expect you to take care of your doctor's appointment, take care of that stuff on that day when at all possible. And it really requires your people to be an adult. And you know, a lot of people don't act like that because they don't feel like they get the same way, they get the same back from their employer. But once you start treating people like adults, laying out your expectations and holding them accountable for those expectations that are laid out, you'd be amazed at what you're going to get out of people. And I know, Melissa, for a fact, there are people listening to us right now nodding their heads vigorously.
Mm.
You know, they're spilling their coffee because they're like, yeah. How about that?
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you've got people who don't meet the expectations of the company, deal with them directly. Don't take it away from everybody. Deal with your outliers. Deal with your people who can't, who've proven they can't handle it. Don't take it away from the people who've proven they can. You're always going to have those few people who can't handle it.
Right.
And
that's
deal
true.
With them. Have the courage to deal with them one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Julie Bauke, I always love connecting with you and doing deeper dives into these stories. I thank you so much for this perspective, and I look forward to chatting again next week.
We'll talk next week. Thanks, Melissa.
All right, Julie on the job here on WICC. So the transition of the news industry has kind of gotten a little bit away from print, television, even radio. And it's really taken form in many ways on social media. And some new research this morning is showing that there are more and more adults who are oftentimes getting their news from a smartphone, a computer, or even a tablet. And that's where their first go-to line of defense is the social media platforms. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about this with Krista Carnes, who's our social media consultant here on WICC. She joins us now. Good morning, Krista. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I hope you are, too.
I appreciate that. Yes, I'm doing fine. I mean, I want to say I'm shocked about this, but I'm not, only because as a news reporter, I can't tell you how many times I get either news inquiries or tips or concerns or opinions from people, and they saw it on TikTok or Facebook or Twitter, and I think, okay, but did you double check your sources, or where did you get that from, or were they even sourced when they posted those things? So I want to say I'm shocked, but I'm really not surprised. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, and I do think, and when you look at the numbers, you know, things use is up. Actually, it's a little down in 20. It was a little down in 2021 since 2020, but I think that's 2020. We were all stuck at home and probably all on devices more than we ever were.
True.
But yeah, I think. I mean, listen, like like you said, it all goes back to the credibility of the source itself. So I think a lot of these news outlets that are investing in journalism, like sort of traditional journalism and not opinion, you know, they are using social media to distribute. It's like a distribution channel. You know, very few people get a newspaper delivered to their home anymore. You know, I mean, the whole industry is changing, and they have to also, you know,
adapt.
They need to get eyeballs to get advertising, you know, because, again, this is a business. What I think is, you know, I think one thing we are grappling with is, you know, unreputable news sources. It's very easy to make your site look like, you know, a traditional news site, but is it credible? Are you just, you know, there's a lot of people that are trying to share, you know, conspiracy theories or, you know, news that has a bias that works for their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And I think understanding where that line is and making sure that you're not just, blindly accepting everything you read.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I know, Krista, this is a conversation you have with your kids, and there are students in your district who also, I'm sure, are also trying to navigate, how do I know if a source is credible? You know, in my day, it was pretty simple. When you were in the library, you looked up in a book, you know, you looked at like a website, and that was kind of the end of it. But how would you suggest to the regular everyday person today, when they see something on Twitter or when they see something on Facebook, or like you said, how do you differentiate that? Oh, this is just a news channel who is using their Facebook or social media platforms to get their already news that's on radio or on television or in their newspapers out to the public. How do you differentiate that it's coming from a credible source, people who are vetted, or just people who are like, listen, I've got a million followers, so I'm worth listening to, but really they may not be.
Right. Or they're taking one little piece of a news story.
Exactly.
And running with that and
yep.
not giving the context. So yeah. So I think, you know, just like I remember learning this in school, like when you had to do a report, like you had to find more than one source to back up your claim. You know, are you seeing this in, some of the old school, you know, the AP, Reuters, you know, when a news breaks, a lot of those sources, you know, come to the story and, you know, they'll have their different thing. I think the other thing is there's, I've taken to looking up things on a website called sourcewatch.org, for example, and there's other websites out there where you can put the source, into their, you know, database, and they'll say, you know, this one has been deemed not credible. This one is pretty credible, but it's, you know, it leans right and it leans left and it's, you know, pretty centered. And, you know, so there are organizations out there that are committed to doing this, but I do think, you know, obviously young people are using, you know, their phones, and they are getting, you know, information about a news story from these influencers on TikTok or on, you know, whatnot. But it's really about encouraging them to go look deeper into the issue, because, again, those people are out there trying to build their audience so that they can, you know, sell their advertising and make their living. So, I mean, I do think there are definite champions out there for certain issues. I think you have to be careful with what's called confirmation bias, that you're not just listening to things that you agree with all the time, because then you might not be getting the full story. And there's a lot of that out there.
We're talking to Krista Carnes this morning, who's our social media consultant. And this is new information that came from PewResearch.org. If you want to read the report, you could see it here. It shows a kind of a diagram. It shows comparative 2020, 2021, and 22, where people are getting their news, whether it's digital devices, television, radio, print publication. And I think you've brought up a couple of really good points, Krista. First of all, you know, when you take 2020 into consideration, people were literally stuck behind screens, and whether it was their choice or they were working from home or they were just bored out of their minds or that was how they were connecting with people, that's really not too surprising. And also, like you said, you know, the traditional news sources like a radio or a newspaper or even a television station, they have to adapt in some way if they want to continue getting listener or viewership and get those advertisements. And so I think it is really interesting. But it's, again, that idea of make sure you have an open mind to when you hear, oh, everyone's getting their news or more and more people are getting their news online. That may not be a terrible thing. It's just that they are getting it not on their television waiting 20 minutes to see the top news story. They're getting it right away, instant gratification, when you agree, on like their websites or on their tablets.
Right. I missed that. I'm sorry. There's a plane flying overhead.
No, that's okay. Hopefully it lands perfectly. I was saying that I think we have to take into consideration that when it comes to getting our news, you know, like sometimes in the past you would wait, you know, 20, 30 minutes till you saw the top headlines on a news channel.
Yeah.
Or same thing with radio. Look, people get the top news from WICC at the top and the bottom of the hour. So for that half hour in there, you're kind of in a waiting game. Hopefully you're not bored out of your mind. You're listening to the show. But, you know, that's what they're waiting for. And with digital, you get instant gratification. You're seeing those news sources right away.
Well, and I think if you can look at it as being a more deliberate consumer, in the same way that you like wouldn't go into a clothing store and just grab anything off the rack and just assume that it's going to fit you, right? Like, because there's sizes and there's styles and there's shapes. Like, so being a little bit more deliberate, because there's so much out there, so much available information. Back when people were watching, you know, 60 Minutes every week and the nightly news with, you know, Tom Brokaw, you know, like there weren't that many channels to tune in. And yes, there might be a little bit of a different take on each story depending on the network, but by and large, they had eyeballs. Everybody sat down, and the next day people felt informed, and they were, you know, with their neighbor, like they could say, did you see Brokaw said last night, blah, blah. You know, so it created conversation and awareness. But now everything's so disparate that I think you have to be a little bit more deliberate on the issues that matter to you. I think it's getting harder. I think a point about all this is that it's getting harder to find hyper-local news.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's been a trending problem for a really long time. But those are the things that affect you every single day. And if you don't know what's going on in your town, you know, that used to be the role of journalism.
Yeah.
You know, is letting you know what affects you, what you might vote on, what you should send letters about. And that's becoming harder and harder. So you have to seek it out. There's always new stuff popping up. But I think for those of us who were like raised on sort of television news as like network television news, it's really hard. And then when everything changed, when the rules changed and all these, you know, MSNBC, Fox News, they became sort of opinion generators.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
You know, they take a piece of news and then they just run with, well, what ifs and the, you know, this could be's and stuff. So you have to like train yourself to listen to what's more opinion and versus what's fact.
Yeah, it's very true.
And don't go overload either. But I do, you know, I need the weather. I need the traffic. You know, I need to know if, you know, the state is going to do something. And I think radio is a great venue for that, because you're going to, you know, people use it every day.
Yeah, it's very true.
I think you're
right, Krista. I think it's something to really think about. And like you said, don't overdo it. But certainly, you know, I think more and more people are starting to educate themselves on what is real and what is fact and what is not and what's exaggerated and things like that. And especially if we're moving to a more digital era, I think people have to be more aware of it. So, Krista, I appreciate you talking about this and bringing this to my attention. And of course, we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much.
Very
I want to welcome back
Melissa,
Fran Mako to the show of AAA. And today we are talking about something coming up in November. But we want to give a little bit of the background, the history of what's called Ruby Bridges Walk to School Day. And we're hoping that more schools in Connecticut will get involved with this movement. Fran Mako, of course, love having you here. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First of all, who's Ruby Bridges for anybody who's not familiar with her?
Okay. Ruby Bridges was a six-year-old girl who was one of the first black students in Louisiana to integrate all-white schools in Louisiana. In fact, I don't know, people are probably more familiar with the very famous Norman Rockwell painting or piece of artwork.
I was going to say, yes, that came out of... Oh, gosh. When did that? Yes, but I know exactly which one you're talking about. I'm sorry.
It's a picture of a little girl in a white dress holding a school book.
Yes.
Walking. And she's surrounded by these very, very tall law enforcement officers. And you never get to see the officer's face. The picture is her, is of the officers from the shoulders down.
Mm-hmm.
But she is dwarfed by these folks. And they're escorting her into this school in Louisiana, and Rockwell called it the problem we all live with. And many people are familiar with that photo, but they just never knew who she was or why he illustrated it. And way back in, actually it's not way back, it was started in 2018. It was this Ruby Bridges Walk to School Day.
Oh,
it's
by young.
A group of fifth graders, yes.
Oh, I didn't know
actually,
that.
Actually, we were AAA school patrollers. And they were studying integration, desegregation in their social studies class. And they learned about Ruby's story. They discovered the photograph or the piece of artwork. And one of the kids asked, if this is so historical, why isn't there a day in her honor? And as part of a class project, they pursued it, and they went to the California State Legislature, and the day was declared. And every year, it's gaining momentum. It's starting to spread across the country. Last year, about 90,000 kids, 36 states participated.
Wow. That's amazing.
Walk. So, I mean, just because of fifth graders, they have highlighted her role in history, so to speak. And because of the interest in, I believe, I'm not really sure if it really took off recently in Connecticut. I know in AAA Northeast Service Territory, a few schools in Rhode Island participated in the event last year.
Mm.
We're trying to promote it throughout our territory. And I know it's early, but I want educators, especially educators, to be aware of this, that the message is racism has no place in the hearts and minds of children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically an opportunity for a community to come together to discuss racial issues of importance, to engage in community programs, considering all the racial strife that this country has experienced over the last decade. And in Connecticut, we're urging communities and schools to visit our website. The website is AAA.com/RubyBridges, to register to participate in the day. And teachers can download lesson plans. They can download a book written by an author named Robert Cole called The Story of Ruby Bridges to complement the lesson plan. And as part of the learning process, kids explore the essential questions that focused on Ruby's actions.
Yeah,
that are pertinent today.
Yeah, I will say, too, we're talking to Fran Mako of AAA, and we're discussing the Ruby Bridges Walk to School Day. If you go to her website, the Ruby Bridges Foundation website, I should say, it actually does say on there, coupled with ending racism, it also just talks about all forms of bullying. And I will say that I know Connecticut, we've had a lot of communities come together and talk about, obviously, ending racism, but every single district has also really been, I think, very focused on bullying, whether it is online bullying, whether it is special needs children being targeted, whatever the case may be. Bullying is something that every single person in America, in my opinion, has been touched by or has known about somebody who has been severely bullied. And I think there are a few really big things you could take away from this. And again, it sounds like this is a national movement. It's gained a lot of traction. And I love the fact, Fran, that this came from young minds. These were fifth graders who said, hey, why haven't we done something? Because too many times, Fran, I think we live in a country where adults are making a lot of really big decisions and they're saying what should or should not be taught to our children or what's significant, what's not. And I kind of love the fact that this whole movement started with kids who were like, hey, this is a problem. Why aren't we addressing it? So I, for that reason alone, I think that's something that would make people go, oh, maybe this curriculum would be great to teach on this day. But also, it really does touch so many different, I think, platforms for our kids to learn about. Like, I don't think kids learn enough about just being kind to one another and not judging people. I think that's something we lack. Absolutely.
Now, I know I can hear it. I can hear it through the radio waves. I can hear people say, nobody walks to school anymore. They're bused. The parents drop them off. You don't have to actually walk to school to participate in this November 14th event. I know it's impractical for many people. So on this day, when kids come together, whether they're bused, whether they walked, whether they're dropped off, they're required to get themselves to school safely. And when everyone arrives, they'll come together as a community, and the day will be spent in individual classrooms, creating we call it a day of dialogue, with various activities and discussions focused on this historical moment.
So we're talking this morning about the Ruby Bridges Walk to School Day with Fran Mako of AAA. And Fran, we don't know for sure, right, how many, if any, schools in Connecticut participate, like have done this in the past, right? We don't have that.
I'm not sure. I don't believe anybody in our territory has.
Well, we need to change that. We need to fix that. We need to fix that right away.
I do. So that's why on the website, if you go to AAA.com.
Okay, I'm going right now.
Ruby Bridges. Okay. Scroll all the way down. That's our school safety patrol page. Scroll all the way down.
Okay.
Your school could register. You could download a lesson plan, teachers, and follow the lesson plan if you wish. You can get the book. The book would be nice. I mean, you really need the book to kind of pull the whole lesson plan together.
Oh, this is cool.
And the whole point, really, is to have schools come together as a community. Even municipal leaders are urged to participate.
Oh, neat.
You know, and in addition to this day of awareness, I mean, we're asking kids, teachers, individual classrooms to design or adopt a community project that they'll work on for most of the year. It could, you know, to highlight the day, it could be as simple as an assembly where you bring a speaker in to talk about race relations or bullying or anything that needs to be highlighted among kids. Or you could have kids collect food for the local food bank throughout the years or pick up litter. Or it's up to the school. It's up to the teachers.
I think this is
how
so cool.
They want to celebrate this day.
Yeah, I really cannot imagine even. So as a parent, and I know, listen, I think politics have dirtied so many things in our society, but as a parent, I want to know at the end of the day, regardless of if my son and I agree on politics or whatever, I want to know that my son is a good addition to society. That's what I want to know. I want to know that he's caring to people. He is not judgmental. And whether he's an F student, I could care less. I just want to know that he's a positive addition to society and he's good to people. And what I love about this is it looks like it really targets third to eighth graders, which that's such a prime age. Like they are. We don't give them enough credit. They're very aware of their actions. And actually, it was only a couple of days ago that my son was in a situation where he, I don't know if it was a friend at school, I mean, who knows? 4 and 5 year olds, they're kooky. But he may have heard something on TV, I don't know. But he called one of his friends a loser. He didn't know what the word loser meant. He had just heard it either on TV. Again, I don't know. But immediately I said, why are you calling your friend a loser? And he said, because I think it's funny. And I said, do you know what a loser means? And he said, no. I said, it means that you're garbage. You're the lowest of the low. It means that you don't care about that person. And he said, well, that's not how I feel. I said, then why would you call your friend that? And I think that we don't give kids enough credit that they are so exposed to things, even when we try so hard to control their environments at a young age, that like third grade, that's such a prime age, I feel like, to start doing things like, how do we give back to society? Even when my kid doesn't want to eat, I'm like, hey, there are kids who live in this community who don't have food tonight, so you better not waste that food. Like, these are lessons that are just building good human beings. This is not political. I think we need to do a better job of building good human beings. And so, like, I love this concept. And I'm just looking at your website here. So it's really as simple as, like, if they register with you guys, does it cost anything? Like, what do schools need to know this morning?
We're trying to track this year. Trying to track how many folks, how many schools are actually participating. And in our territory. And if you go on the national website, and it's a weird URL, it's rubybridges.foundation.
I noticed that. Yeah.
You know, there are other resources there. It's basically a foundation to help kids and to promote. It's called A Day of Dialogue. And again, projects are suggested. They're designed. One could already exist in a community. I mean, ideally, the whole community will come together. The municipality will come together and vote on what project as a group they want to work on.
Yeah.
That is probably very difficult to do. So, again, it's up to the individual schools. And it's not limited to third to eighth graders. I mean, there's a lot of high school kids.
Yeah.
Who do a lot of good things.
Yeah, I agree. And question, Fran, and I'm not trying to micromanage, but I typically fall into that category, unfortunately. Has your release, has this been sent out to, like, first select men and women and mayors? Because I think, like, if I know from, so I'm from Milford, I feel like if Mayor Ben Blake knew that this day existed, I and I'm not trying to call him out or anything, but I would think he'd be like, yeah, because I know he's all about, like, equality and all of that. Like, I would think he'd send this out to the schools immediately and be like, hey, what can we do? You know, same thing with, like, Fairfield. I don't know. I feel like some of these leaders would be totally on board with doing this.
It's funny you should say that.
Why?
I sent an announcement. I sent a letter to all my school patrol schools. And there's about 150 of them in the three counties.
Yeah.
But I am in the process, and I don't have an email list. So I have to go. There's 50 towns in Litchfield, New Haven, and Fairfield County. I have to go through each of those towns to get an email. I have to build my own email list. I do not have an email list of first selectmen.
Well, let me help you, Fran, because I certainly do. So if you want me to send you some.
Really?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Are you kidding? During the pandemic? Oh, my gosh. Fran, let me help you, because I think this is an amazing movement. Again, that's without any politics involved. Like I said, I think we don't do enough to make our kids into just good human beings and just caring for one another. That's really one of the purposes, I think, that we're on this earth. So, yeah, let me just send you my list.
You don't have a list of school superintendents, do you?
I know some of the superintendents. Let me send you what I have. Yeah, I will email that to you at the end of the show.
Extremely helpful.
I got you.
I mean, I need to, you know, I'm doing this much early. I mean, it's very early for November.
Well,
but
I think,
I need a
Fran,
running start because I do other stuff.
Yeah, I think, Fran, we should do another segment in, like, mid to late October, and let's do something else on this. No, I think this is really neat. Like I said, I think people are always looking for, like, what laws can we pass? What can we do to better our schools and better our kids and better our education and stuff? And I'm like, it's days like these that are just so, to me, very easy, very, very easy to do. And all it takes is just a little bit of planning and putting it on your calendar, and you can make it happen. So let's see if we can work together on this one. Fran Mako of AAA, I really appreciate
you.
Yeah, I got you. I think it's a great idea. I think it's fantastic.
Okay.
So,
and if anybody is interested, they want more information, have them email me. It's fmayko@aaanortheast.com. If they have suggestions, let me know. I'm always open to different opportunities here.
Yeah. Let us know. You can always also email me directly and I could send them to Fran. Fran and I talk quite often, so let us know what we can
okay.
do. And I think this is a great idea. Thank you, Fran, for presenting it. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care now. Until next time.
All right, looking forward to it. Fran Mako of AAA here on WICC. November 14th is Ruby Bridges Walk to School Day, and we're trying to see how many Connecticut schools will get on board with this movement. It is a national movement, and it really teaches about just accepting each other, of course, ending racism, but also combating all forms of bullying, which is very important as well. So you guys may remember back about a month or so ago, I had on a local author. Her name was Lisa Franco, and she told the story of Donald and Marjorie Story and their love letters from World War II. And maybe you remember it. The book was called My Dearest Darling, and these letters she actually found while she was up at the Cape. She was in like a thrift shop, and there was a box of hundreds of letters in there. And she went through all of them, she read them, and she tracked down the family who actually has ties to Connecticut. They were living here, and the couple's, one of their children still live here in Connecticut. And so she wrote this book based on a couple from so many decades ago. And this story that I saw in Hearst Media, actually one of you sent it to me yesterday, it reminded me of this story. And it's at the Trumbull Library, where they have come across some photos that date back to the 1930s. And they want to know who's related to them. Where did they come from? So for the story this morning, we have Trumbull Library Director here, Stefan Lynn Nielsen. And Stefan, welcome to WICC. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. So first of all, Stefan, how long have you been the library director in Trumbull?
6 years now in November.
Okay. In your job, in the course of the work that you do, have you ever stumbled on something like this 1930s photo album?
You know, we get all sorts of things donated, you know, when it comes to the books, everybody, you know, leaves a bookmark in there, maybe a receipt. But this is definitely the first time that we have, a whole section of somebody's photo album included in the donation. So we are eager to find the original owner so that we can reunite them.
Okay, so take us back, Stefan. How did this all get started? How did these photos end up in your hands?
So, we recently restarted our book sales and we've been receiving donations. We think that this set of donations came in the last 2 months. We can tell that it looks like they were part of an album at some point. They have some sort of black paper that they were attached to. That's fairly easy to see. And then on our last book sale on September 18th, one of the volunteers found it as we were setting things up in the morning, fell out of one of the nonfiction books that had been donated over the past 2 months again, and alerted us to the location. And since then, we decided that immediately thereafter that we were going to try and find the original owner, simply because obviously these photos are not digitized and they're probably not on anybody's hard drive. So we were concerned about making sure that, you know, whoever's family this is, that they get back to the original owners.
That's amazing. So what are the photos of?
They look like, there's a couple of older adults that look fairly recognizable. Their headshots. The vast majority of them are of a young girl, maybe 3, 4, 5 years old. Over a course of a couple of years, I think the first photo actually we kind of looked at it closer the other day. It looks like it says 1937,
wow.
and it goes up to 1941.
Oh my goodness!
There are about 22. Pictures in total, and and some of them have like what looks like I think a grandparent in it. There's also one with a cow. There's a young girl, a older grandfather kind of person, and a young cow who I guess he's trying to hold so that she can, you know, pet the cow.
Oh, how cute. So does it look like this is all from one family?
It looks like the girl is the same girl in the full set of the pictures.
Okay.
There's only one picture of an adult young lady that is, in two of the pictures by herself. It looks like a fall picture, maybe. She has a outdoor kind of outfit on, and it definitely looked like these were somewhat posed pictures. So they definitely look like nice pictures, and it wasn't like one of the accidental photos that we now take with our cell phones that we don't seem to care about. Somebody was very deliberate in taking these pictures.
Mm-hmm. Now, Stefan, I've got to be honest with you. I've never been great at math. That's why I talk for a living. But if I were to do some quick on-the-spot math, the little girl, if she's like 3 to 5 years old, give or take, mm-hmm. If these were in 1937, 39, this woman would be pushing 90 years old at this point. So is the hope here that that it would be her kids or her grandchildren who would go, oh, my gosh, look, there's Ma.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what we're kind of hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
One of the theories that one of my staff members came up with was that perhaps this had been some sort of like a student project at school where they had gotten these photos from.
Oh, true.
A grandparent, and they were doing a project on the grandparent, which is kind of how they all ended up together is
a mystery.
Yeah,
absolutely. And we're talking this morning, as mentioned before, to the Trumbull Library Director with this incredible story to share. His name is Stefan Lynn Nielsen. And these photos, you guys have them at the library right now. Are they on display? Are they locked away somewhere? Like, where can people see the photos for themselves to determine if they know who's in them?
Well, we did post it originally on Facebook with the intent of trying to reach all the people that are kind of following us.
Mm-hmm.
We also have our contact information there in case anybody wants to, if somebody feels that they can recognize somebody in there, that would be great.
Yeah.
We only posted 3 of the photos because they were the clearest, and they were also more recognizable. These were the headshots of the adults. We may have to end up posting more of the photos somehow so that people can have a better idea of who it might be, or one of the photos might trigger a memory in someone.
Yeah. Well, I do hope these photos find their forever home very, very soon. And Stefan, I appreciate the work that you guys are doing at the library to connect them with their original owners. Is there a number or anything people can call if they come across them, they look at them and they say, I think I may know who they belong to?
Yes. So they can certainly call the library. The telephone number is 203-452-5197, and and just alert me. My name is Stefan, and I will be happy to speak with them at any point in time.
Well, Stefan, we really appreciate you being on the show this morning, sharing this story, a really amazing story. And as I mentioned, I really hope these photos find their forever home very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you again. And let's see if we find these photos where they belong very, very soon. We'll keep you updated here on WICC.